recognize some that you hardly even heard of. People who worked and suffered and struggled for fame.
All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here on a Monday morning, and that means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We were talking about talk show moments last week, and then we're going to go into talk show hosts and jump into that a little bit, about the best hosts of talk shows, and maybe we can get into great guests as well, because we were talking about these great moments, but I want to get into talking about some of the best hosts in talk shows. That's going to come up. And it's Monday morning. That means it's time for the movie reviews. Colin is back. We want to thank Jim Leskowski. We were going to have him on, but he's under the weather, so we can give him a proper send-off. And he'll be back in January. But I want to thank Jim Leskowski for filling in for Colin, who took a little time off. But Colin is back, and he'll be here every Monday through the new year. And then he's going to take some time off again after that. But we welcome Colin back. And Colin and Eric are here, and they join me every Monday morning to review the new movies. And we got movies to talk about, but also the Chicago Film Critics Association. The results have been announced. We have our winners, and we're going to go through all the categories from that. So the Chicago Film Critics Association announced their winners, and we will get into that as well as the new movies. So let's welcome Eric to the show. Hey, Eric.
Hello.
And Colin. Welcome back, Colin.
Thank you.
How you
good
been?
To be back.
How you been?
Very well.
Yeah.
Very well, thank you.
And are there any movies that you've seen that you wanted to mention in that time you've been off? Is besides the one we're going to talk about this morning at length, but what is there anything over the time that you've been off that you would like to bring up?
Gosh, I didn't think about that, but, there's a few things that aren't out yet. I loved, If Beale Street Could Talk. I know you were kind of lukewarm on it.
Yeah.
Widows, I really enjoyed, I thought that was really terrific.
Yeah. You know, Widows is so frustrating that nobody's going to see that movie because it's just so good.
You know, I think some of it has to do with the marketing of it. I think to say it's like a really, really lame poster. The title doesn't really sound exciting, you know, like that this is going to be an exciting thriller. A movie called Widows just doesn't, you know.
Yeah.
I think there's more of a problem with just, you know, the marketing and things like that that are keeping it from being what it should be.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Welcome back, Colin. All right, Eric, let's start with the Chicago Film Critics Association. Tell everybody about how that was all set up and how the voting went and all that cool stuff.
Yeah, well, we do this, obviously we do this every year, and we talk about it on your show, and, you know, the 61 members of the Chicago Film Critics Association, cramming through screeners and screenings for the last month, probably even longer than that, gearing up for this past week, where everyone voted on the first round of awards, to get up our nominations, which we announced on Friday, and then by Saturday evening, we had the winners all set to go. We had kind of a truncated schedule this year, but everyone got through it like champions, and we had a pretty fascinating list of not just winners but nominees as well.
Yeah, I'm looking at the list of the winners here, and I have to say that I like them.
Yeah,
I think
they're pretty good.
I think these are right on the money. Most of them are pretty much right on the money, and. So now we're going to review Roma in just a little bit, but that turned out to be the big winner this year.
Yeah, yeah, won five of our awards: picture, director, cinematography, editing, and foreign language film. Alfonso Cuarón's film that we're all going to be talking about in just a bit. And I think in a little preview, I think we're all kind of in agreement that if it's not our top film, it's certainly a worthy winner.
Oh, no question.
Of the awards.
No question. No question about it. I mean, it's my God, it's good. and again, Alfonso Cuarón is one of my favorite filmmakers. The guy continues on a streak here, you know what I mean, of just making, and in different kinds of movies, too, because this movie is, I mean, obviously it's incredibly personal, It's not as flashy. Although the visuals are pretty amazing, but it's not sort of like the crazy long takes. Although there are long takes.
Oh, there are that too.
Yeah,
oh yeah.
Yeah. But it's not like okay. You know what it is? There are long takes, but they're not the crazy tracking stuff that he normally does. He's basically just panning. Mm-hmm. He's basically panning the camera from left to right or right to left.
Right.
Most of the movie.
Yeah.
So there aren't these crazy long, you know, like Gravity or Children of Men, like complicated takes. But it's
and yet his pans are better than most people's pans.
Yeah. No question about it. So anyway, so he won the director for Best Actor. Went with Ethan Hawke in First Reformed. Has he won anything outside of... he's won a few Critics Awards for that performance, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's definitely been in the conversation most Critics Awards for it. I don't know. I haven't kept the full running tally yet. I still have to kind of go through that.
Yeah.
But he's been in the conversation since the beginning.
Yeah. Okay, Best Actress. I'm glad that, you know, one of the Film Critics Association has brains. Best Actress goes to Toni Collette for Hereditary, which, you know, I'm thrilled about.
I knew you'd be happy with that one.
Yeah. And I'm you know, again, she's not, the way that things are turning out right now, I don't see her getting nominated for an Academy Award for it, but I wish she would, because it's my favorite performance of the year.
Well, she does. I mean, we're going to take credit for it.
Yeah, okay. All right, I'm all for that. Best Supporting Actor, Richard E. Grant for Can You Ever Forgive Me? I was just talking with someone about Richard E. Grant, and who had just seen the movie and really wasn't familiar with Richard E. Grant's work, and I was like, "Well, you got to get on it."
Mm-hmm. He is going to be in the new Star Wars movie.
Oh, he is.
Mm-hmm. Episode 9.
I would say start with Nail and I. That's one of my favorite performances ever. Best Supporting Actress went to Olivia Colman for The Favorite, another one that I'm very happy about. Although, isn't she really the lead?
No, she's not.
Okay.
I'm tired of having this argument with people. I'm going to take it upon myself this week to actually go through the screener and time the amount of minutes that each one of those women are in the film, because I bet you that Olivia Colman comes up third.
Okay.
Right. I've been having this argument since we kind of decided to have her. We had her and Rachel Weisz in the supporting category, both of whom got nominated. We had Emma Stone in the lead category, and she missed out. So some people are angry with us, but whatever, we're right. Because as far as I'm concerned, either they're all supporting, or if there's one lead, it's Emma Stone. But Olivia Colman, for my money, is unquestionably the third supporting character in that film.
Okay. All right. Let's see. Best Original Screenplay went to Paul Schrader for First Reformed. Best Adapted Screenplay went to Barry Jenkins for If Beale Street Could Talk. Best Foreign Film went to Roma. Best Documentary went Minding the Gap. Best Animated Film. This thing came out of nowhere, this movie.
Yeah.
Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. I haven't seen it, but... you know, based upon the trailers, I was like, what is this? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I was like, what is this? And then I hear nothing but great things about it. Like, people are really loving this movie. And it's one of those movies that it really did sort of come out of nowhere.
Yeah, I mean, I said on a podcast recently, I said, I the last thing I needed was another Spider-Man type film.
Yeah.
And let alone an animated one. I'm like, why are they doing it? Why are they doing this? And seeing it last week, like, I went in and was just like, okay, you know, we'll see how this plays out. And like most everyone else, I was surprised as hell at how good it is.
Yeah. I haven't seen it, but I'm really curious about it now. And then when I saw, when I saw, like, the credits, these are Lego Movie guys. So, you know, like, right there,
yeah,
it's like...
Yeah, Phil Lord co-wrote it, and Miller and Lord co-produced it. They didn't direct the movie, though.
Oh, no, they didn't. But they,
no.
did they write it or
Phil Lord co-wrote it?
No, he co-wrote it. Okay.
All yeah.
Right. All right. Well, again, it came out of nowhere. Colin, you've seen it, right?
Yeah, and I echo what Eric said. I mean, we'll get into it next week, but I mean, really, this is not. I mean, not just a great superhero movie, but it's like an animation lover's dream. There's so much going on in this movie. It's amazing to watch.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's great.
All right. All right. So what else we got here? Where are we at? Cinematography. That went to Alfonso Cuarón for Roma. Best editing went to Roma. Best art direction, production design went to The Favorite, as well it should. Let's see. Best original score went to Nicholas Britell for If Beale Street Could Talk. Best use of visual effects, Annihilation. Most promising filmmaker. Yeah, baby. Ari Aster for Hereditary, and most promising performer, Elsie Fisher for Eighth Grade, which is perfectly which is right. So, because she is so great, in that movie. So those are the big winners. How do you think are you pleased with the way it turned out, Eric?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I think, you know, anytime we have these awards, you know, you might not always get your number one choices in there. I mean, that's just literally impossible.
Yeah.
But, you know, to see, kind of a broad spectrum of types of movies. I mean, Hereditary winning two awards, let alone a major category award, was amazing.
Yeah.
First Reform not being forgotten is just, you know, some little film that came out back in May.
Yeah.
That's how well that movie's remembered. And Roma, you know, it's kind of very hard to argue that that's, you know, not the top film of the year.
Yeah.
So.
Well, yeah, we're going to get into that in a couple of minutes. All right. Well, listen, we'll do it again. We'll do it all again next year.
That's right.
You know, and I'm not kidding when I say, and you guys know this, I have two giant stacks of screeners on my coffee table that I've kind of piled through, and I'm still behind. So.
Yeah, we got a lot to catch up on.
Yeah, sure. And you know what? All this great stuff, you know, it's all, and I haven't even seen Marwen yet. I mean, I just, you know what I mean?
Me neither. Well, nobody has.
I know.
Well, not just, nobody, but we haven't.
I'm just saying that, you know, like, there's, you know, like, I'm trying to complete, I'm trying to make some lists and stuff, and there's a lot of great stuff, and I still haven't seen a new Robert Zemeckis movie, which I know is going to tip the balance at some point. I mean, there's just no question about it. So, anyway, all right. All right, guys, hang on, okay?
All right,
Eric and Colin are here, and we're reviewing the new movies when we get back. And we also have Eric's going to stick around, and we'll do box office as well. So we just wanted to tell you about the Chicago Film Critic Awards and those winners. All right, we'll take a break. We got the news coming up, and then after that, we'll jump into the new movies right here on 720 WGN.
Of light in the skies over Hollywood.
Yeah.
Welcome
back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio on a Monday morning, which means my dad's going to call in and tell a jokey time. That's coming up. We're going to be talking about the best talk show hosts, and covering all ground on that. And because we talked about best moments of talk shows last week, had a lot of fun with that. So I thought we'd get back into that, considering I think we have some of the top hosts working in talk shows at this time period. It's so much fun to watch those things, so we're going to get into that. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. If you want to follow us on Twitter, it's at Nick D Show. And the best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/Nick D Show. All right, let's get back to it. It is Monday. That means we talk about the movies. Brand new movie reviews. Colin Suter is back. He had some time off, but he's back, and so is Eric, and let's welcome them back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, Colin, why don't you start us off with Mowgli, The Legend of the Jungle.
All right. Well, this is another live-action version of The Jungle Book, but it's wrong to think of this as any kind of cash grab or ripoff of the big hits that we saw a couple years ago from Jon Favreau. Because this movie was made simultaneously as that one by Warner Brothers, and is directed by Andy Serkis, who is of course one of the he's the actor who made I'm blanking on it, Gollum and War for the Planet of the Apes and King Kong, and basically just elevated motion capture performance to a whole other art form. Well, this is to be his his directorial debut, but there were many production and post-production woes throughout. And oddly enough, Alfonso Cuarón was at one point brought in to try and fix this movie. He was paid $1 million by Warner Brothers to just come in and try and give ideas for how to fix this movie, and he couldn't fix it to save his life, and he still got to keep the $1 million. So that's what it's like working in Hollywood. finally, Netflix has picked up the film, and ultimately completed, and now here it is. So is it a disaster? Not quite. But there's not a whole much reason to see it either. The story remains mostly the same as other Jungle Books, and the execution is certainly very similar to Favreau's in terms of technical elements and having the creatures talk and given voices by Christian Bale and Kate Blanchett and Benedict Cumberbatch and Naomi Harris, and of course Andy Serkis himself as Baloo. But there are no musical numbers here, obviously, because this is not the Disney product. This is its own thing. And the kid who plays Mowgli is pretty good as well. But there are problems with this movie that keep it from keep me from recommending it. Among them, it's a much darker and murkier Jungle Book film. It kind of wants to be for kids, but at the same time, it's definitely not for kids. It's just kind of joyless, and the characters, it's odd to think that Andy Serkis, who, like I said, is one of the pioneers from that period of time in the early 2000s when filmmakers are trying to figure out how to do motion capture performance and do it really well and make real creatures come to life in this new technology. And he's one of the people who is really important to that. To that aspect of modern day filmmaking, to see a film that he directed that really doesn't look finished as far as special effects go. You can see the cracks. You can see the renderings that just don't look complete. They don't look lifelike. They look like they were attempted back in the early 2000s and never really cleaned up. It's kind of shocking to think about that. But then again, that's what keeps you thinking about all the production woes that they had. And they really couldn't, it seemed like they really just kind of gave up on this movie on a technical level. And just sold it off to Netflix, and they've cut their losses, and that's kind of how it feels when you're watching it. You're watching a movie that is compromised, unfinished, and a loss on many levels. The voice work here, I think, is okay. I think Christian Bale stands out the most. I think the stuff between him and Mowgli, I think that's the strongest stuff in the film. It's certainly the biggest emotional pull in the story. But it's not enough. There's just way too many emotional beats that don't register. Once more humans come into play, you don't really feel a sense of danger because you're not really that invested in the Mowgli character. This is just an unfortunate casualty in Hollywood that maybe could have been something really interesting. I mean, it's certainly, it's not the kinder, gentler film that Jon Favreau made, which was a terrific film. But this is, this was, I think, going after something a little more, with a little more meat on the bone, but just couldn't achieve it because of, whatever happened on the set or what happened in the production or whatever. But this is just an unfortunate mishap from a guy who's really, really talented. He did go on to make a movie called Bright last year. So between the making of that film and the release of this, between the making of Mowgli and the release of Mowgli, he's able to make a more low key film, a low key drama, and there's some good stuff in that movie too. Not a great film, but I think, you know, we root for Andy Serkis. We love Andy Serkis. So, he doesn't deserve to have this happen to him. So I hope the third time's a charm for him as a director. Unfortunately, can't really recommend Mowgli.
Okay. I happen to be, I was a real big fan of the Favreau version of Jungle Book.
Yeah,
I thought it was great, and I went in, because the Jungle Book is like a lot of people. That was a big movie when I was a kid,
me too.
And it was one of the first. It was one of the first movies I remember seeing, and it had a real, real big impact on me. So when I heard that they were making another one that Favreau was directing, I was like, ugh, no. And then it turned out to be great. This one I haven't had the nerve to watch. Like you, I heard all about the behind the scenes stuff, and I really, because I happen to love the story so much that I guess I can wait to see it. But that's Mowgli, Legend of the Jungle. Okay, all right, Colin, why don't you continue? tell us about Anna and the Apocalypse.
All right, well, this is a Christmas high school musical with zombies, and it starts out innocently enough. With the title character Anna, played by Elle Hunt. She's a high school senior, and she's trying to convince her dad that taking a year off after high school would be, the best thing for her. She has a male best friend who, of course, wants to be more than friends. They both work in a bowling alley after school, and they have a pair of friends who are a couple, and an American friend whose girlfriend just dumped her. I suppose I should have said this is a Scottish, or it's a comedy out of the UK. It takes place in Scotland.
Right.
Anna has an ex-boyfriend who's a massive jerk, and it all sets itself up to be like a high school musical. There's a bunch of musical numbers right at the beginning. That just kind of give off that tone. But none of this matters because the next day there's a zombie apocalypse and all hell has broken loose. And there are zombies everywhere, and it's every man and woman for themselves. And the central characters, the first they hold themselves up in a bowling alley and then, make their way back to the high school, and they have to try and find each other and their family members.
All right. Okay, so Colin, hang on, okay?
Yeah.
All right, you guys, hang on a second. We'll take a break right here, and when we come back, we'll hear what Colin thought of Anna and the Apocalypse, and what I thought of Anna and the Apocalypse, and then in a little bit, we've got the box office that we're going to be doing as well, and a slow weekend for the box office, obviously, but we got some stories to talk about in that regard as well for the box office for the week, and of course, we're going to review Alfonso Cuarón's Roma. That's all coming up, so stay tuned right here on 720 WGN. When we come back, we'll get back into the movie reviews right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio. We are here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5 and the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. And it is Monday morning, which means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. We're going to talk about talk show hosts and much more. Right now, though, we are in the middle of the movie reviews. Eric Childress, Colin Suter join me every Monday morning to review the movies. And let's get back into it. Before the break, Colin was telling us about Anna and the Apocalypse. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, so Anna and the Apocalypse, continue.
Yeah, so, this is a movie that, I really wanted to love because I love Christmas movies, and I love when I see one that's off the beaten path and that has horror elements or just, is weird. That's what I gravitate towards a lot. And I, you know, walked in wanting to really be on board with this. I was on board when I walked in. I was rooting for this to be good. And it's just one of those things that I think sounded funny on paper to somebody who probably hasn't seen a lot of zombie movies and thought that this was like a really subversive idea for a musical with zombies, and went about writing some very good songs, but didn't write much of a zombie movie. I mean, there's really not a whole lot of inspired, fresh ideas here. And it's hard to do that in this, you know, today, when after we've had, you know, Shaun of the Dead and The Walking Dead and Romero movies and all that stuff. We've seen a lot of zombie movies over the last, just the last 20 years. And so it's hard to bring something fresh to it. And I just don't think this movie, save for one gag in the bowling alley, that made me laugh out loud. I thought this was just kind of substandard stuff that we've seen many times before. And, you know, throwing in a musical number during a zombie kill doesn't come off as inspired as maybe it sounds or, you know, or maybe it looks on paper. And so I just kind of found myself thinking, you know, that there's a comedic sensibility that is really missing here that is crucial to make this thing really memorable. Edgar Wright had it. And I'm sure I can think of, you know, a few more zombie comedies that had that.
I'm a big fan of Warm Bodies. I happen to really, really like
that. Oh, yeah, sure.
It's a terrific movie.
Yeah, no, there's good stuff in that. And I think this movie really just kind of missed its mark. I think it's a better musical than it is a zombie movie. I think some of the songs are terrific. I like the movie knows what its best song is because it repeats it at the end, and it's called There's No Such Thing as a Hollywood Ending. And, you know, I like the numbers, the choreography, I think is really good. But I just think this is a movie that was made with a certain audience in mind that maybe isn't quite as jaded as we are. And certainly a lot of people are enjoying this movie more than I am. So I'm in the minority on this one. It didn't do much for me. It didn't really, I didn't really remember, you know, there wasn't much in it that I hadn't already seen before. And it just seemed like kind of an idea that was a little, half-baked. And not only that, but the cast didn't really do much for me. I just think the characters just didn't, I wasn't invested in them. Whereas in Shaun of the Dead, I'm invested in whether, you know, or not the, you know, the couple, you know, is together at the end of the movie and the best friend and all that. But this one, I just did not care about the characters. And I think you have to care about the characters and the stuff in order for it to work. It's hard to do campy and then sincere and then a musical number and then zombie bloodbath and make that all work and strike a real balance. And I just think this movie didn't achieve that. It's not terrible. It's certainly, you know, like I said, a lot of people are enjoying it, having a lot more fun with it than I did. Didn't do much for me.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm with you on this one, Colin. And I wanted to like it. Well, you know how much I love zombie movies.
Sure.
And you know, you want to throw in some comedy, you want to throw in some musical numbers. I'm all for it. That's cool. But I'm with you on this. I didn't connect at all with the characters. See, and with Shaun of the Dead, I actually really cared about the characters. Like, I really, really did care. Like, I mean, the scene where he has to shoot his mother is heartbreaking. You know what I mean? And then, and it kind of has no business being that good. You know?
Yeah.
And so you can invest, you know, you can actually make a zombie movie where you actually care about the characters and also get laughs. And that's what Edgar Wright did. And, you know, inevitably, any sort of like zombie kind of comedy thing is going to get compared to Shaun of the Dead because that's the, you know, That's the one that you compare.
Especially if it's out of the UK.
Yeah, exactly. And I wanted to like this movie a lot more than I did too. You know, when I heard that, you know, like one of the critics' quotes was "It's Shaun of the Dead meets La La Land," I was like, "Oh, all right."
Yeah,
but that's not what it is. And yeah, you're right. It's completely inconsistent. You know, and the it does jump around a lot in tone. And I wasn't really invested, like you said, I wasn't invested in the characters at all. There were some moments that I thought were entertaining. I think the lead is, I think she's charming, but I just wish that there would have been more here. And it's only playing in a couple of theaters. And I don't know. I don't know who the audience is for this movie. That's one of the other problems. Now, so this was released in the UK earlier, right? Before it got here?
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah, I think it came out in the UK first, and then got a release here in America. And I'm not sure. You know, it's only playing in three theaters. It's at the River East. It's at the Logan, and it's at the Century in Evanston. The Logan. Where did that come from? What? Doesn't that mean, you know, you see the River East and the Evanston Theater all the time when they have like these smaller releases, but the Logan?
Well, the Logan, I think they probably really wanted to get this because they have the kind of clientele that would gravitate towards this movie. The kind of stuff that they program at late nights. They like this kind of thing, and you know, maybe it did very well for them, so it kind of makes sense.
I guess so. Yeah, I mean, this does seem like the kind of movie that they would program at like midnight or something like that. But Anna and the Apocalypse. The trailer's really fun, mm-hmm. and it made me really look forward to it. I like the idea, and I like the lead. And by the way, Colin, you're right. There are some really good songs in the movie too. So it's not a terrible
movie. But it's a movie that reminds you that you can't make a cult film. But this movie wants to be a cult film, and that you can't do that.
Right.
It has to happen organically.
Right.
And, yeah. So.
And that's always what kind of drives me crazy when filmmakers make these forced movies. You know, look, this is going to be a cult classic. And mm-hmm. I mean that, you know, cult classics happen because the audience, you know, finds it, and it's not. It's one of those things that you have to find the movie. I'm trying to think of another. I know that there's been a bunch of these movies that are like forced. You know what I mean? And I'm trying to think of but it's not uncommon that we're gonna make a cult movie, quote unquote, and then it doesn't work. That's mm-hmm. So. But anyway,
it's like Repo: The Genetic Opera.
Which one?
Repo: The Genetic Opera.
Oh boy, yeah.
Oh yeah.
I haven't seen that. Oh boy, yeah. But there's more.
Or your Birdemics and Sharknados.
Oh,
I mean, those
yeah,
are bad
those are,
movies.
Yeah, those are really. Mm-hmm. Those are terrible. Those are just terrible. But anyway, Anna and the Apocalypse is not terrible. I don't want to make people think it's an awful movie because it isn't. It just doesn't work. It's inconsistent and all that stuff. So I can't recommend it. And this was a movie that I was really looking forward to because it's like. You know, like, I mean, all of the stuff that's a part of this movie is right up my alley. So I was hoping it was going to be good, but it's not. So that's Anna and the Apocalypse. Eric, you going to hang up with that? Are you going to try and see that one or no?
Eventually. I'm probably not going to rush out and see it now.
No, you shouldn't. So anyway. All right. Let's take a break. And when we come back, we have this little movie called Roma to talk about. So we'll do that after we take a break here. Eric, Colin, hang on, guys.
Yep.
All right. Colin and Eric are here, and when we come back, we will talk about Alfonso Cuarón's Roma right here on the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. All right. We'll be right back. Everybody, Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio, and we're here until 5 a.m. And the movie reviews, that's what we're doing. We do it every every Monday morning. Eric Childress, Colin Suter is back, and we've got all the reviews that we're going to do. And then Eric will stick around, and we'll talk box office. We like to tell you what's doing well at the box office and all that cool stuff. Slow weekend for the box office, but you know, then a ton of bigger movies will be coming out in the next few weeks. So we'll jump on those as well. All right, let's welcome the guys back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right. Eric, tell us about Roma.
Okay. As we've been teasing about on the show, this is Alfonso Cuarón's latest film, kind of semi-autobiographical tale about his childhood, but not told through the eyes of himself, but through the eyes of the family maid, played by Yalitza Aparicio. And as the story begins, the family itself is kind of going through a bit of an upheaval. The maid is definitely a part of the family, but is treated better by the matriarch of the family more than the father. And when things kind of get shaken up in the household, the women tend to stick together a bit, especially when the maid, she finds out that she is pregnant. Her boyfriend they had sex and found herself pregnant, and now with very little means to support herself, or exactly, not exactly sure if she really wants to have this child, but, you know, there's really no other choice but to go through with it. And the mother of the family, you know, recognizing, you know, what she's going through, is there to support her through this. And so the film takes us through this, you know, basically this 9 months leading up to, you know, the aftermath of the birth. And, you know, and that's, you know, basically what, you know, we're going through in this film as far as the plot structure is concerned. So this is a movie that I saw at the Toronto Film Festival. We talked about it a bit on the show before. It was literally the last movie I saw at the festival. And while I was watching it, I mean, the movie's going to be available on Netflix starting next week, I believe. But if you have an opportunity to see this movie in the biggest screen possible, it's almost become a punchline now since its debut at the festivals. People have to tell people, you know, make sure you see this on a big screen. There's a reason for that, because this is, you know, quite as commonplace with Cuarón's work, is a visually striking film, to the point that while I was watching it, I felt I was literally being taken back to school, back to film school, particularly, because there are just shots in this film, particularly, you know, starting with the opening shot that leads into the closing shot, and that are just unbelievable and lyrical to look at, that are, you know, images and that are telling their own story within the story, that are just an incredible part of this tale. And, you know, I mean, people, you know, might think, like, well, why am I watching this? Is it, you know, what kind of a plot does this movie have? You know, don't concern yourself with such things, because there are sequences in this movie that are unbelievably suspenseful, things that you wouldn't expect, you know, to pop up in the story. If you're familiar with Cuarón's work, there are lovely little nuggets that serve as inspiration for later things that he would do throughout his career that are really kind of fun to look at. It's an amazing film about the culture and the history of what was going on at that time. There's a sequence that takes place in a furniture store, a baby furniture store, that is just one of the most suspenseful, you know, action packed in a way, infuriating scenes I've seen all year. The performance by Yalitza Aparicio is really, you know, a marvel, silent marvel in many ways, because she doesn't have to communicate as much with her words. I mean, she is a kind of a quiet presence throughout this film, but a forceful one, for certain. And there are scenes in this movie that are funny. There are scenes in this movie that will actually break your heart in two and then break them again. I mentioned the suspenseful sequences. Just everything about this movie, by the time it's over and the the time, by the time it sort of wraps around itself at the end, you just want to go back and freeze frame moments in this film and study them and study bit by bit exactly the way Caron sets up these shots, you know, particularly leading up, you know, there's a sequence that towards the very end of the film where you almost don't know if you're going to survive, let alone certain people in the film. And it's a remarkable accomplishment, and one that I look forward to revisiting many times over the years.
Yeah. All right, Colin, what do you think?
Oh, definitely agree with everything you just said. And one thing I want to go back to is Eric said he felt like he's in film school watching this movie, and it really is true. It feels like a movie that you would watch in film school, but not in not in a pretentious way, but in a way that is pure. This is what film people mean when they talk about film as cinema. There's an expression of the human experience that's being depicted here cinematically, and done so without sentimentality, but with definitely with strong emotion. It's definitely Caron's story and it's personal, but it feels more like a neutral observer of these things. When he chooses to let the camera zoom in on these characters, and it really jumps out more when it feels like more like an intimate experience, because often the camera is back, observing almost like a surveillance camera. Just we talked about this earlier, how the way it kind of pans across the room rather than focusing on little details, so that when you do zoom in on the details, it matters more. And Caron is always doing something interesting with the camera in all of his films, something that he has never done before, or a filmmaker has never done before. He's always pushing the limits for himself and other filmmakers. Even with a big special effects blockbuster like Gravity, he had done stuff that hadn't been done before, and made you go, how did he do that? And there's a little bit of that in this movie too, even though it's more along the lines of Itu Mama Tambien in terms of its scale. There's still like a real adventure to this film in terms of how it's made, made by a guy who has a limitless passion for the art form and definitely a command of it. I mean, he's a cinematographer, he's the editor, a co-editor. And it's his story. It's so born out of a passion for film and acting and characters, and even weaving in all this stuff about, the political upheaval going on around, the way he, would infuse that the same way he did with Itu Mama Tambien in this really intimate story, is just astounding that this guy can pull that off. Again, and I've only seen it the one time myself. Yeah, go see it in the theater. It's playing at the Landmark Century right now. Maybe, hopefully, I don't know, maybe they'll play more theaters. Eric, do you think? I don't know.
It's kind of this is a Netflix thing, so yeah. It's one of these, they're almost like doing you a favor by putting it in a few theaters. I mean, again, we're going to be talking about box office in a bit. Netflix won't even, report, how well these films are doing, even though they're apparently selling out all over the place.
Yeah.
I would not expect it to expand anymore. Maybe when the Oscar nominations come out, they'll expand it, a bit. So, come see the movie in a theater for the first time after it's been out on Netflix for a month.
Yeah. Well, I've heard that there's going to be 70mm screenings at some point in the future, so maybe we can look for that at some point.
Not in Chicago, from what I'm hearing.
Not Chicago?
That's what I've been hearing.
Okay. Well, that sucks.
Yeah.
But,
Yeah, but definitely see this movie. If you can't see it in the theater, you know, I guess see it on Netflix, but see it. It's there's a reason it won Best Picture from Chicago Film Critics. So.
Okay. All right, guys, hang on a second, okay? And then I'll tell you what I thought of the movie. Hold on. There's Eric and Colin. We'll take a break. When we come back, I'll tell you what I thought of Roma right after this on WGN.
Of light in the skies over Hollywood.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It's Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. We're going to talk about talk show hosts and more. We are talking about the movies this week. Colin Suter, Eric Childress join me every Monday morning. And before the break, Eric and Colin told you what they thought of Alfonso Cuarón's new film, Roma. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right. This is a, you know, I mean, I echo everything that you guys said. This is a really special film, if not the best movie I've seen all year, very close to it. But it's one of these sort of, you know, transcendent pieces of work that that kind of goes beyond just, you know, the experience of just watching a movie. There's something more going on here. And you get in the grip of this movie, you know, it's hypnotic the way it's shot, the way that Cuarón shoots it, the way that he pulls you in. Visually, I mean, what can we, you know, we've already talked about how beautiful it is. The photography is amazing. It is beautifully shot, interestingly done, and you know, challenging in terms of the art of cinema, taking it to new boundaries and all that. And on top of that, it's it has everything, you know, that you could want in an intimate film, because it is at times it's very funny, it's really intriguing, and also heartbreaking. There are moments in this movie that are just both devastating and also on top of that, really rewarding. Like, there's the final moments of this movie are just I don't know. I just went through every kind of emotion that you can possibly have while watching a movie, and yet really admiring the look, the technique, everything about it. This is just great cinema. This is above and beyond what we normally see in a movie theater. And this is an exceptional piece of work. Just on every single level. If you can see it in the movie theater, see it on the big screen. If not, watch it on Netflix. I can't. There aren't enough superlative words that we can use to describe this movie, because it on every level, from technical to emotional, this is just as good as it gets. This is absolutely as good as it gets, and it's a remarkable piece of work. And he continues, man. Cuarón just continues to just make movies that are, you know, where he's challenging himself, he's challenging the art form, and he continues to do this on a regular basis. And he's one of the best filmmakers alive right now, and has made, you know, some really important and amazing movies. And this is definitely one of his best. I can't, you know, I could just keep saying it's great over and over and over again, and that wouldn't even do it justice. So, but yeah, that's disappointing, though, Eric, that it's not going to be, you know, the 70mm screenings aren't going to happen in Chicago. That just sucks. It seems like the Music Box would be the perfect place to see this movie.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't heard any updates recently, if there's any kind of breakthrough towards it. But when I was told, some time ago, that they were trying to get a 70mm print for the Music Box to play during the holidays, they were told they couldn't get it.
Mm.
Yeah, why, I don't know. Netflix, at one time, they said that they weren't even, like, striking any 70mm prints of it, which is just, you know, I mean, the whole irony that this gorgeous film is going to be seen primarily on Netflix.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, there's such a rich irony to that.
It's funny because, you know, I mean, it's not on the same level, but it's like Kodachrome was this movie that was you know, that was about film, and I watched it on my tablet.
Yeah.
You know, which is just, there's just something wrong with that, you know? This is a pure piece of cinema, and it should be seen the correct way. And, but yeah, I mean, it's just a remarkable piece of work. It really is. So anyway, all right, next week, well, with all the big stuff starts to come out next week and the week after, right?
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of stuff starting to come out next week.
So we got Ben Is Back coming out next week. We've got Mary Queen of Scots. We've got Mortal Engines. We got The Mule, Clint Eastwood's new movie. We have Shoplifters. We mentioned Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse and Vox Lux. Those are all coming out next week. And, yeah, so we've got those.
And, yep.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Colin, welcome back, man.
Thank you.
And we will talk to you
next week.
Talk to you next week. Okay.
All right.
All right, Colin. Eric, stick around here. Let's do some box office.
Yeah.
All right. Mm-hmm. Well, as we talked about last week, it was going to be a slow weekend, building up to the to all the releases that'll be coming out in the coming weeks. But Ralph Breaks the Internet still number one at $16 million.
Yep.
It's up to $140.8 million. And how is that compared to the original? Is it doing okay?
Well, yeah, I think it seems to be like low on the pace that it's on right now. The low end is going to be like right about where Wreck-It Ralph, the first one, ended up, which is about $189 million.
Mm-hmm.
That would be the low end for this at this moment. It's going to be somewhere between $188 and $220 million. Right now it's on a pace for, so it's doing just fine.
Okay. Number two is The Grinch, $15.1 million. Man, oh man, $223 million total.
Yeah, no. This is really stretched itself out to be one of the huge hits of the holiday season. Another big hit for Illumination for a couple weeks now. It's been projected to do about between 240 and 250, and after this weekend, it's now looking at probably somewhere around 270.
Wow. Well, you know what? I mean, it's that time of year. You know what I mean? It's people.
Yeah.
As we get closer to Christmas, I'm assuming it's still going to be in the. It's still going to be pretty good on the charts, I would imagine.
Yeah, I still know people that are taking their kids to see it, and it's short, too.
Yeah.
I mean, it's only 76 minutes long,
right.
So I'm sure when people hear that, they're like, oh, well, let's go see that.
Yeah, okay. Three, Creed 2, $10 million, bringing it up to $96 million. It'll hit 100, obviously.
Yeah, definitely going to hit 100. The question is now, I mean, inflation notwithstanding, of course, it has a chance to dethrone Rocky IV as the highest grossing Rocky film in the series, I guess.
Wow.
Obviously that doesn't take, the original Rocky and the inflation and all that kind of stuff. But Rocky IV did $127 million, so there's a chance to beat that.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Number four, Fantastic Beasts, The Crimes of Grindelwald, $6.8 million, $145 million in America, but doing very well internationally.
Yeah, it's over $536 million worldwide. But it's funny, only about 25% of its worldwide take is going to be here in North America.
Wow.
So it's going to finish here somewhere around $165 million, which, again, is the lowest grossing, the first Harry Potter film, including the original Fantastic Beasts, to gross under $200 million.
Wow. Okay. Number five, this movie just won't stop. Bohemian Rhapsody, $6 million, $173.5 million total. Wow.
Yeah, and last week we said that it was just about to cross $500 million worldwide last week.
Mm-hmm.
It's now on the verge of crossing $600 million.
That's unbelievable.
Worldwide.
That really is
$596 million through this weekend. It looks like it's probably going to come up just shy of $200 here in the U.S. It's just kind of falling off the pace of A Star Is Born, which is now going to hit $200 million. It did pretty well this week. I guess it was released in some IMAX theaters around the country. Just missed the top 10, and so now that movie's going to make $200 million. But Bohemian Rhapsody, if you had that at $600 million in the pool, you won.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy. Instant Family in at number 6, $5.6 million, $54 million total. Number 7 is Green Book, a movie I wish more people would see, $3.9 million, $19.9 million total.
Yeah, that's like, I mean, if there's another kind of success story, I mean, I don't think it's a full success story yet, but it found enough of an audience that it made as much as it did this week as it did last week.
Yeah.
So it kind of moved up in the standings a little bit, so maybe that'll get people to notice it more. But all the movies opening next week, is a very good chance it gets pushed out of the top 10.
Right. Yeah, that's true. It's too bad because it's such a great movie. Robin Hood at number 8, The Possession of Hannah Grace at number 9, and Widows, which has only made $38 million total. That's really
disappointing. Yeah, and it's also sad. You know, we're getting into award season now, obviously.
Yeah.
And it's really kind of sad when it's become more and more apparent that certain movies that do get wide releases, like Widows, if they do, they don't perform very well at the box office.
Yeah.
Well, and they're not getting sort of the huge accolades from critics and stuff.
Right.
That they kind of fall off the pace for the Oscars.
Right.
And we're going to see that probably with Widows. It looks like we're probably going to see the First Man as well, unfortunately.
That's too bad. All right, what are we looking at for number one next week? Is it going to be the Spider-Man movie?
I think it's going to be the Spider-Man movie. I thought that, I think that The Mule could still do very well.
Yeah.
But Warner Brothers is actively kind of hiding this movie.
Really?
They're not screening it in Chicago.
Mm-hmm. That doesn't matter.
At all. I understand the screening in New York next week, and I got one source told me that there's actually not going to be any Thursday night previews in theaters.
Wow.
Which I thought was kind of weird.
That is weird. Okay, well,
yeah,
we'll see.
That doesn't happen that often.
No, it doesn't. Well, that's Clint Eastwood. We'll see what happens there. All right, we got a lot more to talk about next week. Eric, thanks, buddy.
Thank you.
All right, there you go. Eric Childress and Colin Suter will join me again next week for the movie reviews. We'll take a break right here on 720 WGN.